Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, please subscribe and or follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to pod. To stay up to date about upcoming episodes, articles we're analyzing, and to get to know us, the collective, a little bit better, please like our Facebook page and follow us on Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast and follow us on Twitter at TCP Theater Pod. Reviews are always welcome, as are comments and questions, so feel free to send us an email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, let's get to the episode.
I'm also recording.
Great.
Yes. Here we are. Hello, everybody. I am collective member Lupita Shaw, she, her, hers. And I am an actor, voice actor, and relatively new advocate slash activist. I am recording today on the traditional unceded lands of the Munsee Lenape peoples, past and present, colonially called East Harlem, New York City. And I'm thrilled to be joined today by collective member Sophie Payton and a special guest, my friend Angel Desai. Hi, y'all.
Hi.
Angel is a founding member of APAC, the Asian American Performers Action Coalition, which we're going to be chatting about today. I recently joined APAC Steering Committee after being a fangirl for years. So I'm really excited to talk about their work. And yes, would you all introduce yourselves?
I'm Angel Desai, actor, musician. I do teach occasionally. I am one of the founding members of APAC and on the steering committee. Welcome to us, Lupita. And yes, I am in Manhattan, the unceded land of the Lenape people.
I'm Sophie Payton. I use she, her pronouns. I'm primarily a director, producer, dramaturg, and do some grant writing as well. And I'm on the land of the Dakota people, past and present, colonially known as Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Well, we're going to talk right here, right now, about data. Specifically, we're going to discuss APAC's annual visibility report titled Racial Representation on New York City Stages, which covers employment statistics by race for actors, playwrights, composers, librettists, and directors each season on Broadway and for the 18 largest nonprofit theater companies in New York City. We are recording today, May 18th, and the report that we are primarily going to be referencing is the 2017 to 2018 visibility report. However, the next report, which covers the 2018-2019 season, is expected to drop any day now. So keep an eye out for that. And we may mention a few little tidbits to look forward to. We'll see how that goes. I want to acknowledge before we dive into this discussion that data collection in and of itself can and often is very problematic. Data can be manipulated. There is often a disconnect between who is generating the data, who that data is being used for, who that data is being used by. This phenomenon is explored in really excellent detail in season 1, episode 9 of the Ethical Rainmaker podcast, so check that out. But the short version is that it is usually people with power and resources who get to decide how to use data, which is why it can be cherry-picked when it is presented and why certain people or institutions, the ones with the power, tend to continue getting funding and resources and power, and then the cycle continues and so on and so forth. I find APAC's visibility report to be unique because the people who are generating the data are also part of the data set. And the people who can benefit from that data are those same people. And they are also the same people disseminating the data. It's really quite awesome because at the end of the day, we need to remember that data is people. Data is stories. We have to remember that all the numbers we talk about today and just in general, whenever we talk about data, they're not just numbers in a vacuum. They represent real people in the world with real needs, and in the case of APAC, with a real desire for representation. And with that being said, Angel, I would love to just hear from you. Less APAC.
APAC.
You know, give us a little history.
Yeah. APAC, it has been, oh my God, 10 years now. Oh dear. It was summer of 2011, and one of us, it was Pun Bundu, who had this comment on Facebook, and it was something like, where are all the Asian actors on stage in New York? He had just come back from seeing a matinee of something. You know, he's like, I have an MFA from Yale. I've been in New York for 10 years. I've never even auditioned for Playwrights Horizons. That comment on Facebook produced a comment thread that was over 430 comments long. Ooh. It was this enormous ongoing conversation that just exploded. There was a parallel thread that Ralph Pena, founder and artistic director of Mayi Theater, which for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the Asian American theater companies in town. Ralph is Filipino, and many of the stories, the writers, directors, performers are Filipino, but it's not simply Filipino. It's Asian, you know, all Asian all the time. But anyways, he actually was the one to get a bunch of us together in a room. And a lot of the folks that showed up to that first meeting are not the same steering committee members that are here today. Some have come and gone, Lapika and Vichet Chum being our two newest. And when we started, we all got in a room and we're like, okay, so what do we do? Because we're clearly all angry. How do we address this? And we started, you know, spitballing ideas about stuff we could do. We definitely wanted to have town halls where we could talk to people in groups. We should maybe have tiers of different town halls and, like, you know, really address things. But the thing that I think distinguished us from other groups was we were like, we should take the numbers. We should actually, you know, not to fulfill an Asian stereotype, but we did decide to do the math. And we were like, we need to do the numbers to see if this is our perception and it's all in our heads, or is this actually a thing that's happening?
I think that's something that happens so often, that is this in my head? Am I just making it up? Is everything actually hunky-dory? Is my experience on its own valid? Do we need these numbers to back it up? So I find that very interesting.
Yeah. And you know, to your point about data and its pros and cons, you know, this is a room full of primarily actors, some directors. I can't remember if Nelson Eusebio was there at the beginning as well. Writers, directors, but primarily performers. We were like, okay, let's tackle... We essentially boiled it down to the largest nonprofit at the time, the largest 16 nonprofit theaters and Broadway. As you mentioned, we've expanded to include a couple other off-Broadway houses. But we just did the very tedious legwork of going through online and looking at the cast lists and looking at headshots, but not just looking at them, doing the homework of going, you know, because we're all actors and because some of us are fortunate to have worked at some of these New York theaters, we're like, okay, who knows this person? How can you get in touch with this person? We got to find out. So the data collection process is definitely imperfect and definitely has been improving steadily over the years. But we do the legwork. We go in and we're like, we've got to find out how this person identifies. There are some people, poor things, whom we've asked multiple times because we didn't write it down the first time. And now we're finally, someone was like, can we just have a database, please, so that we don't have to keep asking these people the same questions every year? And we did. We broke it down. You know, I think we may have been going with African-American at the time, but now we're saying Black, white, Latina, Hispanic, Latino, Hispanic, now Latinx, MENA, Middle Eastern, North African. Asian, in which we include South Asian. So East Asian, Southeast Asian, Asian Pacific Islander, South Asian, all the lands there, all the peoples there, the indigenous people. Sadly, that category is so light every year that it just, the work for that, sadly, is, you know, there's just not a lot. That's the one category where consistently every year, it's just like, this is a shame. But just for the history's sake, that first year, we looked back at 5 theater seasons. So it was 2006 to 2011. And oh my God, there was a lot of work. It just took so long sitting there. And the numbers were dismal for us. Off-Broadway, we were hovering around 3%. On Broadway, we were less. 3% of the actors employed were Asian American, and 2.3 or 2.5, something shitty. At that point, it doesn't matter. There was, when we had our first, no, it was our third or fourth forum, but it was big. We had this enormous, all of the littler town halls we had led up to this forum at Fordham University with casting directors, directors, agents, producers, playwrights. Actually, there were 17 of us on stage, but we had all these news outlets there as well, both, you know, TV news, print news, digital news. And I think there were 400 people in attendance. And we were just like, hey, y'all, these are the numbers. And because of the report, And our wonderful graphics designer, who at the time was Siho Elsmore, was like, look, see that tiny little sliver of color that you can barely see in the bar graph and the circle graph? I remember someone was being very specific about the numbers, like, well, it's not 4%, it's 3, and it's not 7%, it's 3. And it's like, it's bad. It doesn't matter. Anything below like double digits is freaking bad, okay?
And let's remember that we are looking at these numbers in New York City.
Oh, yes. Yes, this is right. New York City, which is because we were thinking, does it represent the people of New York City?
Good question.
And it's like, no, actually, because if you look at the population of Metro New York, not Westchester and the surrounding counties, but Metro New York, in 2010, the census showed that it is not a majority white city. Only a third identify as white. 29% identified as Latino. The worst proportionate representation in terms of New York's metro population is by far Latino peoples or Latinx peoples. It's by far compared to how many actually live here and have populated the New York metro area for decades. And they were, at that year, they were 4%. They've never really gone above like 6 or 7%. I'm not even sure they've gotten to 7%. It's ridiculous. And of course, Asians, as I mentioned, very low down, even though our metro population was at the time was around 12%. I'm sure it's much more now.
Yeah. And so I know that APEC started to answer the question, where are all my Asians at? And were you primarily at the beginning looking just at performers, just who was on stage?
Yes. I can't remember when we started doing directors and writers. That's relatively recently. Well, we were looking at the whole pipeline question. It's like, so wait a minute. So why is this happening? Aside from the fact that it's clear that in our personal lives, we still experience various micro and macro forms of aggression, racial aggression, whether it's just ignorance, people thinking they're super nice, but they're super ignorant, and just trying to pay compliments that some of us still get, which is like, wow, you speak English really well, things like that, or just plain out racial slurs. But in the industry, the evidence being just not being cast, or if we are being cast, being asked to play a foreigner again. We were like, so what are the roots? And in the first forum, that's why we included directors, writers, producers, casting directors, agents, because it was like, are you calling us in for a role? If you're not having to be racially specific about a certain role, are you thinking of us for these roles? Why aren't we getting called in for this? Why aren't you thinking of us for this? Is it because plays are not being written with us in mind? Is it because directors aren't willing to see us? Is it because producers are not looking at material written by and for Asians and Asian Americans as viable, producible material that's going to get a good audience? Like, what are the issues? And obviously, the answers are very complex. There's not going to be the same answer for every path. The nonprofit theaters, each of them are different. With Broadway, the bottom line is money, always. But still, the question remains, every time you go to a show that has a primary cast primarily consisting of people not white, suddenly you see audience members of whatever that race is filling the audience. So it's just like, I don't understand how producers don't get that if you just put more people of color on stage, you're going to get more people in the seats. If so, anyway, I'm on my tangent, but that is why.
Your work has been recognized by the OBs, right? You have gotten this OBE. There is an award.
Yeah, for equity, diversity, and inclusion. Yeah.
It was like, this work is important and deserves an award. But in what ways has APAC seen the impact of the work? Like, have you seen changes in the data over time? And perhaps just us personally, have we seen this data used in any way?
I can jump in. I mentioned when I saw it in the Black Theater Matters bill that's been circulated since the AEA convention that happened back in April. And in the very beginning of it, they quote APAC and they say, where is the money going? Who received those jobs? According to the Asian American Performers Action Coalition, 85.5% of the directing jobs in New York City went to white directors. They go on to list a few other facts that really just lay out the discrepancies between who's getting these jobs and where the money is going. And it just really stood out to me because in this conversation about data, right, there's like such a gatekeeping that's happening. You have to have good data to get good funding. You have to sort of like prove your worth through numbers and evaluation. But it's really hard to get good data without good funding, which is what I think this history of APAC is what's so incredible. Because I sort of internally thought maybe there was a third party, like a research firm or someone. And to hear that it was just all of you together for, I would assume, years, perhaps, putting this together, just makes me think about, oh my goodness, where was the funding for that? Where was the hourly wage for all of those people?
We wonder the same thing, Sophie. We spent many years going, this is a lot of work and no one's paying us to do this. So, wow.
But what's incredible is that now that those numbers are here, how many other companies, how many other coalitions and groups can then take this data? And as sick as it sounds, it does then legitimize them for funding from certain foundations. And while I don't think that should be true, that is how the system works right now. And while I wish we could like retroactively go back and pay, and perhaps that is something that will happen in the future, it is kind of incredible to see this data now being like a community sharing resource for anyone who sort of needs to prove these like insane racial and economic disparities in the industry.
Yeah, it's gratifying to see that people, you know, take it seriously and are using it. I mean, we accept donations. So if anyone listening would like to go to donate to APAC so that we can put out these reports, we give ourselves very nominal fees that are so like insulting. They would be insulting if they weren't ourselves trying to give ourselves honorariums here.
But
we have started employing a graphic designer, and the money that we have gotten through the wing, not, I don't think from the wing, but through the wing, goes to pay a professional graphic designer. The report last year, I just thought was so stunning.
It was the first time I'd seen those graphics laid out like that. Mm-hmm. That was a really brilliant use of money. Also crazy that...
Yeah, it's been a bit. I'm going to look up Alyssa's last name, our graphic designer, because she deserves a shout out.
It creates the sort of chicken egg question for me, which is the data that is being collected, Sophie, as you were saying, it usually requires so much funding and so much other support. But amazing that that wasn't there. It was just a bunch of performers, really, who had questions and went out seeking those answers in your copious amounts of free time. compiling all this information, which led to people realizing, hey, this data is important, and perhaps some theaters or other institutions using the data that you were creating, which then maybe led to, here's a little bit of funding, and how are you going to use it? It's not enough to pay all of you, but okay,
no,
get a graphic designer. Let's make that choice. It's mind-boggling.
Alyssa Achacoso is our graphic designer. It just became clear that it was like, well, we've got this report, but first of all, our poor friend Siho, like, and our poor friend Jake Manaba, Alan and Jake and Siho, they were doing all of this help and not, and also for free. And it was finally like, we, you know, Siho's got other stuff that she's got to focus on. We should really pay someone whose job is this, because Siho's an actor. As you've come in, Lipika, to the group, we have now also done some internal restructuring. And not to bore everybody with that, but there are some of us who would prefer never to have to collect a single number ever again. and we've sort of subcategorized ourselves according to where we think our strengths are. I'm happy to do things like this, interviews, discussions, conversations, talking to students, talking to groups of people, but the data collection drives me batshit crazy. And then there are other people who are like, I actually love doing that. I do not want to be in front of a mic or a camera for this. They want to be there as that way as an actor, but not for interviews.
It's a lot. And I wonder, I pose this question to the two APAC members who have been sort of spearheading the main writing of the report, as I understand it, which is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Angela, is that Han and Julianne really spearhead the drafting the text of the report?
Well, yeah, they're drafting the text because they're doing the math.
They're crunching of the numbers, the analysis, and then drafting all of the, like, what does this mean? So I asked both of them, you know, for them, what has been surprising? You guys have been doing this for how long now? You started in
10 years plus the look back that we first did was the 5 years prior. So that we have the data from 2006 to 2019 seasons,
okay.
Theater seasons.
Okay. So I asked both Han and Julianne, like, what was something that was surprising? You've been collecting this data, looking at it for so many years now. Were there any trends you're seeing? Has anything moved in a surprising way?
Right.
So Pun wrote back to me. He said, the biggest surprise for me is outlined in the sector comparison section, Broadway versus nonprofits. For 10 years, we have seen an industry making slow gains and responding to the pressure to diversify. And I'll say that part of that was probably from the numbers they're seeing in the report. Like, let's hold up this mirror and you can't deny that. You can't. It's very easy for places to deny experience when people are just saying,
yes,
the Asians, but you can't deny numbers, right?
Well, some people don't care about the numbers. I think that's what they, they look at it and they're like, I don't see any problem with that.
Right, right.
So
good point.
You know,
so you've been seeing these sectors responding to pressure to diversify, who are patting themselves on the back for tiny, tiny gains, you know, 2% a year, very little gains. In the report that's about to come out, so spoiler, something shifts. Pun talks about how both sectors tried to ramp up their efforts to diversify, but Broadway continued to do it in the same way they had been. So in yes, we totally have inclusive casting. We're going to cast diversely for the chorus. So roles that are not prominent on stage, not lead, not featured in the chorus.
Right.
Look at all the diversity we have.
or a couple of, there were a couple of featured roles that they,
yes,
literally a couple, like literally three.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah.
Do you really get to pat yourself on the back? Because what stories are still being centered? Whose experiences still get told? Who are we actually seeing, you know, on stage?
Right.
So that was on Broadway, but the nonprofit sector, Pun writes, for the past couple of years, they have been investing more in BIPOC writers. And in the 2018-2019 season saw more of a focus on stories about, not just by BIPOC writers, but about the BIPOC experience, which resulted in a section that I found fascinating, which asked the question, if you have BIPOC writers, BIPOC stories, does that result in more BIPOC people, not just writers, on stage and behind the scenes? It's a really good question.
Yeah. And it seems to be like, it seems like it should be obvious. And guess what? It kind of is. It wasn't always the case necessarily. And there are always outliers, you know, but if you're getting at what the trends have been or what changes have we seen over time?
Right.
Yes, there have been some gains. This is overall, and I would say that Black artists, in New York theater, I'll be very clear, in New York theater, in these theaters, in terms of increased presence of actors, writers, and directors, although in the writer-director, especially the director land, it's still pretty poor, but it's better. But Black artists saw the most gains, have seen the most gains. I personally think that is very related to the fact that Black Lives Matter issues have taken national conscience, have taken a global conscience. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this past year, everything kind of exploded. But I think that that's, you know, it's been undeniable that there are things that just needed to be addressed. So in terms of numbers relative to, if we're talking about numbers relative to population size, mm-hmm. Black actors are now their numbers on stage are greater percentage-wise than the percentage of Black people living in New York, at least according to the 2010 census. That may, that may not actually be true. We don't actually know the 2020 census numbers
yet. Someday we'll get that information.
Someday we'll, yeah. Yeah.
But also, I think that's great.
So,
because
it's important.
It's super important. And who has been the only demographic to be overrepresented?
It's still the percentage of white actors on stage is still way over what they actually are.
Yes.
Maybe not in the US, maybe not generally speaking. And one could argue that for Broadway, the audiences for that are as national and international as they are the city. Broadway is not for most city residents because most city residents can't frickin' afford to go to Broadway. So, however, trend-wise, that is great for Black artists. Asian artists, it's like it's incremental. But here's the thing that I tell people these days when they're like, aren't things better? White people especially love to say, but things are better and you should really acknowledge that things are better. I'm like, but here's the analogy that I like to tell people when they say things are better. I'm like, things are better for Asian Americans in the way that it's better that a patient has been moved out of the ICU and into a regular hospital bed. So yeah, we're out of the ICU, possibly, not far from it, but we're still in the frickin' hospital and we're still hooked up to machines. We don't need to be, but you're keeping us here. So, hey, how about we all just work a little harder on disconnecting those machines? And for anyone listening to this whose first response is, why don't you create your own work? I'm just going to tell you to fuck right off. And here's why I'm going to say that to you. We have been doing that for decades. Mm-hmm. Hello. We've been writing our own work on stage, on screen, producing our own albums, doing our own podcasts, blah, 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 blah. That has been around for decades. Do you even know about the Asian American theaters that exist in this town? Mm-hmm. If you don't, that's not on us, because we advertise it. We invite you to shows. When's the last time you actually checked some of that shit out? People have been writing their own shit for decades. If Broadway can only see fit to produce David Henry Hwang, you are not doing your homework. I love David. David's freaking talented as hell. He is not the only playwright that is talented. Yeah. So to everyone listening who has these responses, that's not the problem.
100%.
Thank you.
I'm just going to take a moment and rebel.
Sorry, Sophie. Sophie's still here, by the way.
I'm here. And I also, like, I do just want to say, like, only is it important to say that, like, this work has been happening. And, like, there are plenty of people who are from underrepresented in theater identities who are making their own work and running their own theaters. But it's also, those theaters are not being equitably funded either. So, like, it's not you know, like, you can't just say, like, go make theater over there. Like, I mean, it's just, it is absolutely asinine. And the fact that, like, there isn't equal, if you're going to say that, you have to fucking fund that too. You can't say that and then also not give, like, more money to that work and then just keep supporting a PWI who's going to do a bunch of EDI work and get, like, $80,000 for it.
And by the way, and we're going to, I think the report covers some of this, a lot of that EDI work that some of those larger PWI, and for anyone listening who doesn't know that PWI stands for primarily white institutions, places like the Roundabout that get all of this funding that it, because they're hiring people behind the scenes in these small jobs or smaller roles, get applauded for that. When the people who've been doing the actual work to support communities of color, like, I'm going to just say this, and I think that it's covered in the report, and I know she wouldn't mind. Mia Kadigbak, who is the artistic director of NATCO, the National Asian American Theater Company, has been applying for years to the Schubert Foundation. Years. They don't even return her frickin' emails or calls. She has invited them to her shows. She has sent them the numbers, and they do not even give her the time of day. She stopped a couple of years ago. She was tired of getting ignored. She has been working tirelessly for decades, and they haven't done shit for her. So this is a systemic problem. It is a huge problem.
Yeah. I think Oogie was talking about this in the previous episode, the idea that there are theaters that are doing this work. We exist. Mm. They're smaller and they're drastically underfunded because nobody cares.
Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's so intentionally manipulated. Like, I was listening to the Art Equities Talking Back series recently, which is just, like, awesome. But one of the things that they're talking about that, like, I've also noticed just in my grant writing work is how a lot of larger corporate foundations shifted giving to arts and culture to give to social justice. And so now theaters, primarily white theaters, are shifting their mission, programming, whatever it is, to be now, like, quote unquote, social justice oriented. So Roundabout, which, like, in the economic impact statement is, like, 6 times more money for white actors. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, not only are you, like, significantly higher giving percentage to white actors, but you're also, like, putting your people of color or your artists of color in these tiny roles and then getting a ton of money for it, where companies run by people of color who are, like, somehow their work isn't considered social justice just because they're not doing white people now don't get that money. Yeah.
No, it's a very good point, Sophie. It's asked backwards because, and this is what I hope theater founders, if you're listening, of course it's social justice work. Of course it is social justice work for theaters, especially those concentrating on a specific race or ethnicity. That is the social justice work, to give voice, to center the stories of people of color. That is the whole point. Just because it is in the form of art, not even just because it's in the form of art. If you don't understand that is where art and social justice, that is where they become this holy matrimony. If you don't understand that, then what the hell are you doing running a funding organization for the arts? Of course that is social justice work. We're telling those stories to validate, not just validate our existences, but to elevate them, to center them, and to reach out to the community in general to be just like, hey, guess what? We are part of this community. We are here. It is recognize our humanity. Because when you go out of the theater and someone attacks somebody of color because they don't like their skin color or their eye shape, guess what? Maybe it would have helped if they just had, they were surrounded more by images and stories about people where we're just humanized. If you could just see us as human beings that are equal. There's something about this. I don't know. Is it now a good time for a tangent, or did you have something, Peaks, that you wanted to?
Go ahead.
Well, because, so there's the theaters like Natco and Mai Yi that are, you know, Classical Theater of Harlem, that are specifically, they're for the community, for specific communities. But the other thing that I want to caution everybody about too, or just, well, maybe caution isn't the right word. It isn't just about segregation, because what ends up happening when people are like, well, here, Mai Yi have this much money, and here, this, of course, they deserve to have the money and they should, so that they can continue their own mission. But our mission at APAC, and I think performers in general, we just want, and this is a social justice thing, we just all want to be, we are all here on this land together. We want to be seen as equal. We want to be considered equal. We are Americans. So you will demonstrate your understanding that you and I are equals if you include me in your storytelling, if you include us in this. It is both give more money to those theaters like Natco and Mai Yi. It is also expand your idea of what it means to cast diversely and include us, you know, in place when you're casting non-traditionally or inclusively in other theaters with other writers of other colors.
I think it's important that in the court, there is a breakdown of who is on stage in the chorus and in a lead role. And what is that discrepancy there? And I believe coming up, that is going to be dug into even further, like broken down even further, because it's kind of hard to say, yes, Broadway has increased so much diversity when, as we mentioned before, it's just in the chorus role. So who gets to be up front? Who gets to be included? Whose stories get to be told? Still the same. And was it last year that was the first year in which the economic impact against actors was included in the report, where you could see, like, for every white actor you hire, you're paying them a dollar and you're paying actors of color this much?
Because we were talking about theater size, I think it was last year we applied it to the report that is ultimately the, is it the 16-17 and 17-18? We were behind, as you will see. And obviously the theater seasons 19-20 and 2021 are going to be, you know, we don't know what that is, but we were behind because we're all performers. And perhaps one of the nice things that may or may not have been a result of the report is that we've been working more as a group. But to answer your question, Peaks, I'm not sure, but I think that last year was when we started looking at the theater sizes. So for places like Lincoln Center or MTC or Roundabout that have a bigger space and a smaller space, or at least one big space and one smaller space, to see what the economic disparities of salaries are in those spaces.
I was just going to echo how powerful that section was, how grateful I was that they started including that, and how incredible it was to just see those numbers lined up against each other of like Roundabout $6 to $1, you know, and just that disparity just felt really clear when breaking it down into money like that. I also, it really stuck out to me that the negotiated salaries from Broadway aren't transparent and aren't able to be found. And that was infuriating and mind-blowing for me.
I don't think that'll change anytime soon, but I also can understand why you wouldn't. It's complicated, because especially if you have stars that are in a show, I wouldn't want anyone coming to me and asking me what my negotiated salary is if I had managed to negotiate something for myself. I can understand why that's private, but I think it's also important just to notice the fact that you can negotiate certain salaries and then others cannot. I think it's less about what the specific amounts are, but the fact that some people can negotiate and some people can't.
And the people who can negotiate are usually the ones with leading roles. They're usually people
who already have lots of money, since Broadway seems to think that only TV and film actors can do leads in shows in theater, regardless of whether they have training or not.
And what's interesting to me, just as like a director producer side of things, is directors and designers often do get to negotiate that fee. And so I have seen sort of on that side of things, there's sort of a push for pay transparency around that of like, well, I want to know if I'm your sound designer and the set designer is making this much more than me, but they get to dip halfway through tech, you know, like, and I have to stay through the last preview. I want to know what those fees are. And even if, you know, I do think that there's definitely like a personal side of it that should be respected 100%. But I also sort of am like, who's getting shafted? And I do sort of...
I can tell you that right now. You don't even have to look at the numbers to tell you who's getting shafted.
For sure.
That's the smaller roles, which is why it's sort of like, great, Broadway. Guess what? Diversity doesn't just mean chorus roles. Yes, it's great if you're in the chorus and you have that job, and that's wonderful. But the practical problem is, like you're saying, those salaries are not necessarily negotiable. And then... although I don't know what's true for people who might have been going from show to show as a chorus person. That's probably the one time when your skill set allows you possibly to go from show to show. I mean, you still have to be lucky enough to be able to do that and audition well and all of those things. But if you can sing and dance and you don't mind being in the chorus for a long run, people like that are really valuable. It could be, I don't know this, I'd have to talk to someone who's done a lot of chorus work. But it could be that you could negotiate those salaries after a while. I don't know. But yeah, for the featured and lead roles, those are the ones that, you know. I forget what the number is for Broadway wide actors this year. Really, 18, 19. You don't happen to remember, do you, Apiko?
I have it. So I don't know about Broadway, but just in general, the main graphic is 58.6% of all roles on New York City stages went to white actors in the 2018 to 2019 season. Making them the most visible on stage. This is the report that's going to be dropping soon for 2018-2019. White actors continue to overrepresent by over 25% relative to their respective population size. So it's still, that is a trend that continues from the beginning of the report, that who do we see on the stages has not really changed. I think it's
changed a little bit.
A little bit.
To include more Black people.
Which is great.
Which is great. And also. And also. Great and.
It makes me wonder about this idea of like the scarcity model. Like there seems to be this mentality that, oh, more Black actors are working, more Black directors are working, more Black playwrights are working, which I will caveat by saying, again, it's not that many. And it's great that the Black artists are being able to be represented more. Is that enough? It feels like the theaters are saying, good, our work is done. But there are so many other people that are unrepresented. If you're talking about the Indigenous artists out there,
they're not represented. I'm just going to say they're not.
They're not. They're zero.
Because it's been either zero or 0.2 or point or like one. 1% is not a number. That's a person. And one poor person bearing the sole burden of representation for an entire theater season, that is pathetic. Not on that person's part, on everyone else's. Yeah. By the way, the numbers for Broadway plays, leads versus featured, principals versus chorus. 73.5% of roles in straight plays were cast with white actors. 89.7% of all lead roles and 72% of featured roles, white people. So that's 26% and 26.5% go to BIPOC actors. So they are, yes, definitely making more money.
Sit in that number for a second.
Yeah.
Sophie, I'm really curious, as the one person in this convo who does not live in New York City, what were you thinking about when you read the report? What struck you? What questions did you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are pieces of the report that are jaw-dropping, shocking, and then there's much of it that you sort of go through and are like, ah, yes, the number that I assumed there would be a number in that range, and there is that number representation of that thing I assumed was already overrepresented. There were several things in there that were quite surprising to me, that 100% of Broadway musical directors are white. 100%.
Yes. Some of those musicals are about BIPOC experiences.
That was another one that really shocked me, that like 64.7% of BIPOC productions were shaped by a white director. First of all, that sets a message for a lot of young white theater artists that something is okay that's not okay. I also think that I wonder why that's happening. Is that a producer thing? Is that an artistic director thing? Who is the gatekeeper for that? how much power do those playwrights have? I sort of wanted stories behind some of those numbers.
Yeah. The writer, when it comes to Broadway, the people with the power are the money people. So all decisions ultimately get filtered through the producers. So if the producers say no to any part of that equation, it's not going to happen. As Rachel Chafkin said in her Tony acceptance speech, it's not a pipeline issue, but I think it tends to get framed as one. The argument tends to get made, well, maybe they're just not as good, or maybe there are not as many good ones. And it's like, you're not sprung brilliant overnight. There are occasionally those people who are sprung brilliant overnight, and they're young prodigies. The rest of everybody else are good, and they get better with practice. And you have to give them that training. There are people of color, directors of color, training all the time and directing all the time, not just training by working, like getting experience working. But you have to give them a chance to do it. You have to give them a chance to do it. And it really is about just going, I value you as much as I value this. You have a different directing voice, a different style, but it is valuable because it is different. And especially if this is a play about a certain ethnicity people, or if it's about a BIPOC experience, and it's, or if it's primarily BIPOC actors, oh my God, hello, can we get somebody who speaks a similar language, if not the same language?
So bringing in a white person in that space, you are like inherently just like choosing to cause harm, it feels like.
That would also imply that every white director means harm. I don't think that that's true.
And thank you for catching me on that, because that is an unfair assumption.
Yeah, but it can and has, as we know. And sometimes you can have a great director, and as we've all read recently, that doesn't matter because the producer is a giant a-hole. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the writer is, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, but you bringing that up, it goes back to the gatekeeper issue, right? Who has the money? He who has the money, or she who has the money, or they who have the money, have the power. And it seems to be the same few people who are in those positions when it comes to the theaters that the report covers, to the mm-hmm. point where, for the next report coming out, there is a section on gatekeeping. There's now a section, APEC has added a section to dive into those numbers and try to figure out what that story is. What is the economic impact of racism? What is the trouble with gatekeepers? What is the thing that is maintaining this system where the trends are not shifting that much? And they haven't for the past 10 years, at least, probably more.
And more.
You know, one of the things that sort of I kept, because the report's 90 pages, right? So like you get to page like 30.
Oh my God.
It is. And it's amazing. And a lot of it is at the end, of course, those grading systems and everything, which are really, really wonderful. But you start to sort of see the trend pretty early. But the question that sort of kept coming up for me is like, you start going through the pages and you're like, it's not talent. Like, it's definitely not talent. Similar to what you were saying, Angel, right? It's not. And so the fact to hear that there's a gatekeeping section in this new report is really exciting, because it's like we have to just name that this is bias now, and we have to just deal with what that is, because you can't keep pretending like we're operating in a meritocracy when we're clearly not.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a tangent going back to percentages and numbers when it comes to the report. A white actor started an argument with me once when I was describing the report. Well, this person tends to be argumentative about a lot of things, but as I learned, their question was, why are the percentages being compared to, when it comes to performers, being compared to population sizes in New York? What about the percentage of Asian American actors in Equity? And so, which I thought was really interesting, I don't have the math brain to figure out why that's not the vector that we're examining. I'm pretty sure, though, I'm not even pretty sure, I know for a fact that the number of Asian people on stage per year is a tiny percentage of the number of Equity Asian actors that are actually out there. I don't know what those are. I wonder what that would be. It's not possible to know those numbers because Equity doesn't release its, or right. until recently
it's,
hasn't
I think
released.
It's, but it also, that argument brings up another question, which is like, are the only actors available actors who are already in the union? That there are so many actors there. And so many of the actors who are performing on Broadway and in New York are not necessarily just New York residents. People come from other places. People move recently. You know, like,
Right. There's although they do have to become equity in order to be on those stages.
So it broadens the scope, but they don't necessarily have to start that way. When they audition, they may not be in the union.
I think it's moot anyway, because we don't necessarily know the numbers. But I know that I can, you know, I personally know hundreds, like literally I personally know hundreds of equity actors. And it's like when there's only 12 of us on stage in a given season, it's like, I'm pretty sure that's a shitty percentage too. And maybe it's not 3%, but it's shitty.
I mean, it also goes to like who gets to see themselves on stage, right? I was in high school before I saw someone who looked like me on a Broadway stage, you know, in that musical, that Bombay Dreams. I'm just going to say it. But it was like, I will date myself. But that was it. That was the one thing that was allowed to happen. There are many problems with that show and with the casting of that show. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other podcast episode. But the first time that I saw people who looked like me on stage who made me think this is something I could do for real and not just in my imagination. And then it didn't happen again for a really long time. So I guess it's not just a matter of like pairing the percentage of actors on stage to the percentage by race in the union.
It's not.
Representation does matter. And that's what the data keeps showing us.
And it also, you know, the fact that you're like, when's the last time we had that kind of a new Asian musical on stage? It's, you know, after Bombay Dreams, it's like that. It just goes to show. Yeah, it's, as you said, Sophie, not a matter of talent necessarily, although I did hear that there were problems with that show. I auditioned for that show and was that's a whole other, I'll tell you that story over drinks. That's a different podcast. But but yeah.
And then it also just like, why is it that white stories are the only ones that are universal?
And also, why are they the only ones allowed to flop and then come back? It's not like every single white musical or play that's out there has recouped its losses. Y'all know for a fact that they have not.
I mean, that's the thing. It's not about risk, right? Like this person isn't like picking where your numbers are coming from because they're interested in finding equity faster, right? Like if you're making it about like which representation of numbers are we finding our core data in, it's just, for me, it just comes back to like, what is theater here for, right? Like if we are primarily in regional theater and we are in service to a community, the community that you are in service to is New York City. So the people that you should represent is New York City. You shouldn't represent actors in equity. That's not your community. They're not the ones who need to be represented demographically on stage. And it just...
That's the larger argument. You're right, Sophie. And that is... I had, of course, lost the thread. But that is the point. That is the larger point about not making it about a percentage of equity actors, right? Because we're telling stories exactly about people. The people who come to see... And as I was saying earlier on in this conversation, if you build it, they will come. Hamilton's not the first example of this. And Hamilton, like, you know, that's a stage full of freakishly talented people, amazing people. But that's not the first time it happened. How long did Rent run? Rent was this totally multi-culti cast, and it ran 4 years. What, decades? I don't remember exactly how long Rent ran. What are the other things that have run for years, you know? And you see it in TV and film as well. It's not like you're going to lose money if you mix it up on stage. You're actually probably going to make more money. You will probably make more money.
And since that's the only thing that the gatekeepers seem to care about, I think it's really important that APAC has started including that.
It's like if we can't motivate you based on, you know, it's ironic that these foundations are giving out grants based on social justice when it's like you're clearly supporting theaters that don't give a fuck about actual social justice through representation for people of color and for the brown peoples.
It's a lot of words.
But so it's like, but if you did, hello, start with just, you know, hiring us.
Yeah.
Hire us.
Well, with that in mind.
Yes.
Hire us. What do y'all hope for the future of the report? Feel free to answer any of these questions. Yeah. Like what is your vision for what this report can do? Like, do we want this report to be replicated? Do we want other areas of the country to have this? Like, does APAC want to be able to stop doing the report? What conditions need to be met for that to happen? You know, what is the hope? Where do we want to go from here?
I mean, it's a good, scary question. I think this was a line that I wrote for one of us to say in the OB acceptance speech. We exist so that we don't have to exist. We don't want to have to exist. None of us came here to fucking take numbers about who's on stage and who's giving this much money and who's getting which grant. Fuck all that noise, because we came here to fucking act. But when you're prevented from acting, when you know you're right for a part, but your skin color or your ethnicity or your eye shape or whatever the fuck it is preventing you from getting that part. And not, as you say, Sophie, talent or experience or intelligence or even comportment in a room, which is also part of it. What the hell? But we don't want to have to exist. So personally, speaking for myself, I don't want to have to do this much longer. But there is, you know, I'm doing it for as long as I've got the stomach to do it and the bandwidth to do it. But I also feel like I don't know how much would have to change for the report. Putting aside me personally, in terms of the APAC report for it to exist, I think things would have to change pretty drastically. But funding for actors in general, regardless of color, sucks. Okay, we are the lowest budget line item, or one of the lowest budget line items on budgets of so many theaters, which to me is ass backwards. It is fundamentally, it is, how do you not understand that the actor is the only thing you need to create theater? You don't actually need a set. You don't need lights. You don't need costumes. You don't need any of that shit. Sometimes you don't even need a script. You need a bunch of smart actors in a room, and we will tell you a story and we will entertain the shit out of you. We might possibly even enlighten you. The fact that we are not valued for what our actual position in the theater is, which is that we are the theater, that it happens because of us and only us. No, sorry. That's wrong. Not only us, but if we had to, if you ran out of money and you could only pay one artist out of all the artists that make theater to do something, to tell a story, you need the actors to do it. That's who you need the most. The fact that we're paid the least is absolutely outrageous to me. I am in an absolute rage about that. I guess what I'm hoping is that, I mean, the report specifically is about race, so it is about equity. But there's, I guess I'm bringing that up because there is a fundamental restructuring. Oh, and this is what I was going to say to actors listening to this out there. Our biggest power is to get together collectively, which is why unions are important, which is why APAC works, is because we are a group of people. Because if there were just one or two of us making this noise, then it would just be, oh, Angel's on her crazy rant again, I can easily ignore her. But there is a group of us, and we've stuck together, and we've made it public, and we've gotten more of us to share their voices, to just say, we're not okay with this. This is not okay. And when it comes to money and the larger issues, racial equity is, of course, tied, as we're proving, to money. But it is within our power to just say no to the things that we don't want. So my hope for the future for this report is that, yes, it's not needed, because more and more people have come onto the bandwagon of just being like, stop doing what you're doing. And if you're not going to stop what you're doing, then we're going to stop what we're doing. You need us. If we all sat down together collectively to say no, what would you do? That's where I leave it, I think. Because I kind of just feel like we as a group, and I mean we all actors of all colors, need to stop putting up with bullshit.
And I would even add in to what Angel, you're saying, across discipline too, across department in theater, in addition to just mm-hmm. actors of all colors. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Say that a little bit more, in a more detailed way.
I have heard of stories where the entire company of actors goes to the artistic director with huge issues of culture or harassment or something mm-hmm. that are not then respected just because they're the company of actors, right? So then the director, where was the design team? Where were the other people who can advocate and show up that maybe have a little bit more power in that room? Because if we're not standing up for each other in this, then like, we're not gonna, no one's gonna go mm-hmm. anywhere.
Right. And that it's disheartening to hear that. And I would say if there is ever another group of actors where that happens, the next thing you do is you just collectively go and you sit down in the middle of that rehearsal room and you don't move until they make the change that needs to happen.
I think I also long for a day when this report is not needed to simultaneously validate the experiences of BIPOC actors, because I feel like we have in New York, we have these stats to point to when people say ignorant things like, you're getting so much work, you're like so hot right now. And I'm like, I'm not. Thanks. One. And two, I long for a day when the stats are not needed because the stages look like our city. And I know that New York is not alone in this problem of overrepresentation of certain groups and overrepresentation of certain stories and certain stories we've talked about on this podcast, certain stories and people being allowed to fail upwards and other people not being given the chance to try. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long, it's going to take a long time and it's going to take a whole lot of structural change in the industry. But until that happens, I feel like this report is such a valuable tool for marginalized, is the word I'm going to use now, because it's the only one that's coming to mind, for marginalized communities.
Underrepresented,
oppressed communities to have a little bit of power in their corner.
If it's helpful, I think it has been proving helpful. More and more people are citing it. Eileen passed around the Hollywood Reporter's article for today.
Yes.
Asians and Pacific Islanders account for less than 6% of speaking roles in Hollywood films, as study finds. And they looked at 1,300 popular films from 2007 to 2019. 6% of speaking roles in movies. But it doesn't take anyone doing the numbers to see it.
Mm-hmm. It takes the people in power, like, to see it. That's what it takes.
Yeah, and to care, to actually care.
Well, clearly, so much work to do in our industry, theater industry, and in the film industry. So before we end, I just want to say, A of all, thank you to APAC, and thank you for joining us today, and sharing your rants and thoughts and all these things. Thank you, Sophie, for bringing in your insights. To read past visibility reports, y'all visit APACNYC.org, APACNYC.org. Follow them on social media at APACNYC. Stay up to date about their work. Their latest report, which is going to cover the 2018-2019 season in New York, is going to drop real soon. I was going to ask if there are any other resources that you guys would like to share.
Yeah. AAPACNYC.org/donate. If you want to donate to this report and this work continuing, please do that there. I also just want to call out, Lapika mentioned the podcast, The Ethical Rainmaker, that is led by Michelle Shireen Neary. And I can't recommend that enough. It's about nonprofits and ethical fundraising and sort of going back through the history of that. The other thing I want to plug is just a book that I, full disclosure, have not read yet, but I'm really excited to read. It's called Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America by Ujima Olowu. And that, just to read a little bit, just because I feel like this has a huge play into what we're talking about. What happens to a country that tells generation after generation of white men that they deserve power? What happens when success is defined by status over women and people of color instead of by actual accomplishments? Ujima exposes the devastating consequences of white male supremacy on women, people of color, and white men themselves. And I just want to name that is a huge problem in this country and a huge reason why we're seeing the numbers that we're seeing in this industry.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sophie.
Whew.
Thank you all for having this idea and for asking us to come on.
Wow.
And thank you for reading the report and having such great insights to share about it.
I cannot tell you how excited I am to read the next one. No. Maybe that makes me nerdy, but I'm like 100 pages of data, give it to me.
And for anybody who may feel intimidated about even opening the report based on the number of pages that you're hearing are in it, the good news about Alyssa's wonderful graphic design is that if you do want to skim through it, you can, because those graphics are going to be pretty clear.
Yeah. Check out the charts. And I think there will be lovely summaries on the socials. Oh, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon. Yay. I wish there was a way to like translate into audio the faces that Sophie and I made when you said that stat.
And I was reading the thing, so I didn't see it. Can you make the faces again just so I can see them? Oh. That's like horror mixed with grief mixed with like...
When you said the number of films that they went back to, that's when I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Thanks again for tuning in. To hear more about why APAC's work using data to impact the visibility of Asian American performers is so crucial, especially in our current climate, please go back and listen to our special episode from April 2nd, honoring AAPI communities. And we hope that you'll continue to join us on the first and third Friday of each month for new episodes. To stay up to date, please subscribe on the podcast platform you're currently listening to and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at TCP Theater Podcast and Twitter at TCP Theater Pod. We really appreciate your reviews, comments, and questions, so send them our way via email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com or through any of our social media. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Herrera,
Lilia Hushmand,
Lupika Shah,
Oogie Push,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Watch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari.